I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, and we are tonight and every night this week through Thursday at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. We're at the red, white, and blue draped Fleet Center tonight. It is day two of the Democrats' big party, with everything pushing toward John Kerry's formal nomination on Thursday night. Last night, the hall was lit up by former President Bill Clinton. Tonight, delegates will hear from Dick Gephardt, Howard Dean, John Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, Ron Reagan Jr., and Illinois' Barack Obama. Ted Kennedy will take the podium very shortly to deliver what may be a kind of handoff to John Kerry. We will be following all of this with you tonight and talking as we go through it tonight about John Kerry's biography and how it sells. Up next on Point, everything at the Democratic Convention on Point. Jack Beatty, here we are. Robert Caro, presidential historian, at the podium right now. Quite a sight. I guess talking about, he's written, of course, about Democrats and big ones. But coming right behind him will be Ted Kennedy with this speech, which is, everybody's writing, the kind of torch handoff, though he's still big and powerful in the Senate, witness everything he brings to Massachusetts and Boston. But John Kerry's been in his shadow as the junior senator from Massachusetts, and maybe now out of that shadow.
Maybe now indeed out of that shadow. Yes, Robert Caro is the biographer, of course, of Lyndon Johnson, and I've just been listening to the Johnson tapes. In 1964, after Teddy Kennedy was in a frightful aircraft, a plane crash, he was in the hospital in traction, and Johnson called him up and he said, "You know, I just think it's terrible you are, that you got a big, rich future ahead of you, young man. I just think you're a great politician." And sure enough, he turned out to be. Like him or not, just as an objective truth, there is no greater senator in point of legislation passed in the last 40 years than Edward Kennedy. Conservatives wouldn't dispute that. They'd just say they didn't like the legislation. But the distinctive thing about it is whether No Child Left Behind with Bush or the immigration reform with Reagan or, deregulation with Carter, wherever it is, he has worked with people in the center on the right to get the people's business done. As an orator, he's the old-time religion Democrat. As a legislator, he's a guy who say, give me 5 yards if that's all I can get, and if I have to work with Orrin Hatch, so be it.
You know, Jack, the theme of our hour tonight, as we listen in on the convention speeches, and we will turn to Ted Kennedy when he takes the podium here, the theme is really the John Kerry story. They have been selling that biography hard this week and are going to be selling it even more vigorously in the remaining hours and days of this convention. And how that story, what is that story, how it resonates, how it plays with the American people. Helping us with that conversation tonight is going to be Joan Vinocki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, great having you with us tonight.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
Joan, you have written just today, Joan, that in effect, John Kerry is now, as Jack's alluded to, kind of stepping out from, stepping away the Kennedy shadow that he's worked in for many years.
Well, if you can't do that when you've been about to be nominated for president, I don't think you can ever do it. Right, exactly. Sometimes, you know, columnizing is all about stating the obvious, Tom.
Ted Kennedy now shaking the hand of Robert Caro, waving to an audience that has been supplied with a sea of Kennedy banners. He's a polarizing figure in the broader American political spectrum. He is clearly much loved on the floor of the Democratic National Convention here tonight. Ted Kennedy has stepped to the microphone.
Thank you, Bob Caro. Thank you, Bob Caro.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob Caro, for that generous introduction.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob Caro, for your generous introduction. And with the continuing support of the people of Massachusetts, I intend to stay in this job until I get the hang of it. To my fellow delegates and my fellow Democrats, I've waited a very, very long time to say this. Welcome to my hometown. Welcome to my hometown. To Americans everywhere whose aspirations have been kindled anew by this campaign, we who convene here this evening in Liberty's cradle say, welcome home. Welcome home for the ideals born in Boston and strengthened by centuries of service and sacrifice. Ideals like freedom and equality and opportunity and fairness and common decency for all. Ideals that all Americans yearn to reclaim. And make no mistake, come November, reclaim them we shall by making John Kerry President of the United States.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point at the Democratic National Convention, where Senator Ted Kennedy is at the microphone.
These fundamental ideals light the fire in each of us to do all we can, and then more, to see that next January, John Kerry has a nice new home at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It fills me with pride to have our Democratic Convention in this city, this hallowed ground that gave birth to these enduring American ideals. Like my grandfather and my brother before me, I have been privileged to serve this place where every street is history's home. The old North Church, where lanterns signaled Paul Revere. The old State House, where John Adams said independence was born. The Golden Steps, where waves of new immigrants entered this new land of liberty and opportunity, including all eight of my own great-grandparents from Ireland. Here in New England, we love our history, and like all Americans, we learn from it. We breathe it deep because it sustains us, it guides us, it inspires us. It was no accident that Massachusetts was founded as a commonwealth, a place where authority begins not to a single ruler, but to the people themselves, joined together for the common good. The old system was based on inequality. Loyalty was demanded, never earned. Leaders ruled by fear, by force, by special favors for the few. Under the old unequal system, the quality of your connections mattered more than the content of your character. Your voices were not heard. Your concerns did not matter. Your votes did not count. The colonists knew they could do better, just as we know we can do better today, but only if we all work together. Only if we all reach out together, only if we all come together for the common good. Now it is for us, the patriots of this new century, to do that, to shape our own better future and make it worthy of our past, to choose a leader worthy of our country, and that leader is John Kerry. Today, more than two centuries after the embattled farmers stood and fired the shirt round the world, the ideals of our founders still resonate across the globe. Young people in other lands, inspired by the liberty we cherish, linked arms and sang, "We shall overcome." When the Berlin Wall fell, when apartheid ended in South Africa, and when the courageous protests took place in Tiananmen Square. The goals of the American people are every bit as high as they were more than 200 years ago. If America is failing to reach them today, it's not because our ideals need replacing. It's because our president needs replacing. We bear no ill will. We bear no ill will towards our opponents. In fact, we'd be happy to have them over for a polite little tea party. I know just the place, right down the road in Boston Harbor. For today, like the brave and visionary men and women before us, we are determined to change our government. I've served for many years in the Senate and have seen many elections, but there have been none more urgent and more important than this one. Never before have I seen a contrast so sharp or consequences so profound as in the choice we will make for president in 2004. So much of the progress we once achieved has been turned back. So much of the goodwill America once enjoyed in the world has been lost. But we are a hopeful nation, and our values and our optimism are still burning bright. Those same values and optimism are what brought our forebears across a harsh ocean and sustained them through many brutal winters that inspired patriots from John Adams to John Kennedy to John Kerry. And their strong belief that America's best days are still ahead, there's a reason why this land was called the American experiment. If dedication to the common good were hardwired into human nature, we would never have had a need for a revolution. If each of us cared about the public interest, we wouldn't have had the excesses of Enron. We wouldn't have had the abuses of Halliburton. And Vice President Cheney would be retired to an undisclosed location.
Hall on its feet for that last comment from Senator Ted Kennedy.
Soon, thanks to John Kerry and John Edwards, he'll have ample time to do just that. Our country demands a great deal from us, and we rightfully demand a great deal from our leaders. America is a compact, a bargain, a contract. It says that all of us are connected. Our fates are intertwined. 50 states, one nation. Our Constitution binds us together. Yet in our own time, there are those who seek to divide us, one community against another, urban against rural, city against suburb, whites against blacks, men against women, straights against gays, Americans against Americans. In these challenging times for our country, in these fateful times for the world, America needs a genuine uniter, not a divider who only claims to be a uniter. We have seen how they rule. They divide and try to conquer. They know the power of the people is weakened when our house is divided. They believe they can't win unless the rest of us lose. We reject that shameful view. The Democratic Party has a different idea. We believe that all of us can win. We believe we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And when we say all, we mean all. Today, in this global age, our goal of the common good extends far beyond America's borders. As President Kennedy said in 1963, in his quest for restraint in nuclear arms, we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Interdependence defines our world. For all our might and for all our wealth, we know we are only as strong as the bonds we share with others. The dangers of terrorism and nuclear proliferation, our greatest challenges, are shared by all nations. And our greatest opportunities, from achieving lasting peace and security, to building a more prosperous society, to ending the ravages of disease and the despairs of poverty, can all be seized, but only if the world works together and only if America helps to lead in the right direction. And John Kerry has the skill, the judgment, and the experience to lead us on that great journey. The eyes of the world were on us, and the hearts of the world were with us after September 11th, until this administration broke that trust. We should have honored, not ignored, the pledges that we made. We should have strengthened, not scorned, the alliances that won two world wars and the Cold War. Most of all, we should have honored the principle, so fundamental, that our nation's founders placed it in the very first sentence of the Declaration of Independence, that America must give a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. We failed to do that in Iraq. And more than 900 of our servicemen and women have already paid the ultimate price. Nearly 6,000 have been wounded in this misguided war. The administration has alienated longtime allies. Instead of making America more secure, they have made us less so. They have made it harder to win the real war on terrorism and the war against Al-Qaeda. And none of this had to happen. How could any president have possibly squandered the enormous goodwill that flowed to America from across the world after September 11th? Most of the world still knows what we can be, what only we can be, and they want us to be that nation again. America must be a light to the world, and under John Kerry and John Edwards, that's what America will be. We need a president who will bind up the nation's wounds. We need a president who will be a symbol of respect in a world yearning to be at peace again. We need John Kerry as our president. Time and again in America's history, we as Democrats have offered new hope of a stronger, fairer, more prosperous future for all our people, a society that feeds the hungry, shelters the homeless, cares for the sick, so that none must walk alone. And when the elderly face poverty and sickness that threaten their golden years, we created Social Security and Medicare. And when the voices of many citizens went unheard and their lives were blighted by bigotry, we fought for equality and justice and for civil rights and voting rights and rights for women and for the cause of America with disabilities. We fought for those. And when higher education was beyond the reach of veterans returning home from the war, we created the GI Bill of Rights, and we have continued ever since to make college more affordable for millions more Americans. And when men and women needed protection in the workplace, we demanded safe conditions for their jobs. We insisted on the right to higher pay for working overtime, and we guaranteed the right to form a union. And we pledged a fair minimum wage so that no one in America who works for a living should have to live in poverty. Only leaders who know this history and abide by the ideals that shaped it deserve to be trusted with our nation's future. Sometimes in recent years, they have fooled us with their rhetoric, but we will not let them fool us twice. In the White House, inscribed on a plaque above the fireplace in the state dining room, is a prayer, a simple but powerful prayer of John Adams, the first president to live in that great house. It reads, "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it."
May I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening to Senator Ted Kennedy of the Democratic National Convention.
Under this roof. In November, we will make those words ring true again.
Crowd on its feet again for Senator Ted Kennedy.
All of us who know John Kerry,
many Kennedys in the audience,
know that he's a fitting heir to these ideals. I've known John Kerry for 3 decades. I've known him as a soldier, as a peacemaker, as a prosecutor, as a senator, and as a friend. And in every role, he has shown his strengths. He was the right man for every tough task, and he is the right leader for this time in our history. John is a war hero who understands that America's strength comes from many sources, especially the power of our ideas. He knows that a true leader inspires hope and vanquishes fear. This administration does neither. Instead, it brings fear. Fear of rising costs for health care and for college. Fear of higher unemployment and lesser pay. Fear for the future of Social Security and Medicare. Fear of greater bigotry. Fear of pollution stain on our magnificent natural heritage. Fear of 4 more years of dreams denied and promises unfilled and progress rolled back. In the depths of the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt inspired the nation when he said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Today we say, the only thing we have to fear is 4 more years of George Bush.
Senator Kerry with a two-fisted speech. It's moving toward its conclusion now tonight. Audience,
John Kerry offers hope. John Kerry offers hope, not fear. The hope of real victory against terrorism and true security at home. Of good health care for all Americans. Of Social Security that is always there for the elderly. Of schools that open golden doors of opportunity for all our children. Of an economy that works for everyone. That's the kind of America we'll have with John Kerry in the White House. And the roots of that America are planted deep in New England soil. Across this region are burial grounds. Many so humble, you find them without intending to. You're in a town like Concord, Massachusetts, or Hancock, New Hampshire. You're visiting the old church there, and behind the chapel you find a small plot. Simple stones bearing simple markers. The markers say War of 1776. They do not ask for attention, but they command it all the same. These are the patriots who won our freedom. These are the first Americans who enlisted in a fight for something larger than themselves, for a shared faith in the future, for a nation that was alive in their hearts, but not yet part of their world. They and their fellow patriots won their battle. But the larger battle for freedom and justice and equality and opportunity is our battle, too. And it's never fully won. Each new generation has to take up the cause, sometimes with weapons in hand, sometimes armed, only with faith and hope, like the marches in Birmingham and Selma 4 decades ago. Sometimes the fight is waged in Congress or the courts, sometimes on foreign shores, like the battle that called one of my brothers to war in the Pacific and another to die in Europe. Now it is our turn to take up the cause. Our struggle is not with some monarch named George who inherited the crown, although it often seems that way. Our struggle is with the politics of fear and favoritism in our own time, in our own country. Our struggle, like so many others before, is with those who put their own narrow interest ahead of the public interest. We hear echoes of past battles in the quiet whisper of the sweetheart deal, in the hushed promise of a better break for the better connected. We hear them in the cries of the false patriots who bully dissenters into silence and submission. These are familiar fights. We fought and we won them before, and with John Kerry and John Edwards leading us, we will win them again and again and again and make America stronger at home and respected once more in the world. For centuries, kings ruled by what they claimed was divine right. They could not be questioned. They could not be challenged. The people's fate was not their own. But today, because of the surpassing wisdom of our founders, the constant courage of the patriots of the past, and the shared sacrifice of generations of Americans who kept the faith, the power of America still rests securely in citizens' hands. In our hands. True to our highest and noblest ideals, we intend to use that power. We will use it wisely and well. We will use it in the poet's words, my brothers loved, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. We will use it to heal, to build, to hope, and to dream again. And in doing so, we will truly make our country once more America the Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy addressing the Democratic National Convention in Boston. The crowd is on its feet. He's given a traditional two-fisted Democratic speech here, pulling out all the language of the Democratic cupboard and framing the contest this year for the presidency in very old terms, almost the terms of 1776, that is, the people against a king, and he nearly named that king George. We are talking tonight about the junior senator from Massachusetts, the one who's running for president tonight, and the story about and of his life that is being pushed throughout this week and throughout the campaign of Senator John Kerry for the presidency. The John Kerry story, the Kerry biography, and how it's selling for 2004. You've been hearing it all week long. You hear a lot more of it as we head into the fall campaign season proper. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you getting the picture of John Kerry? What's coming through to you about who John Kerry is? Do you like what you know? Do you like what you see? And what does John Kerry's chest full of medals from Vietnam mean to you? Does it say he has the courage to lead? Is it overplayed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight with me at the convention hall, Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, great having you with us here.
Thank you, Tom.
And on the telephone tonight, Douglas Brinkley, author of the Kerry Biography Tour of Duty, director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies and professor of history at the University of New Orleans. Good evening and welcome, Douglas Brinkley.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our own Jack Beatty, news analyst for On Point, is with us as well, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Joan, let me turn first to you. Many Americans are being introduced to John Kerry for the first time in this week, we are told again and again, and no doubt it is true. How would you capsulize the Kerry story that the Democratic Party is looking to put out in this campaign season? Who is John Kerry, formally?
Well, I think one part of Ted Kennedy's speech spoke to that. He called Kerry a soldier, peacemaker, prosecutor, and friend, describing him in, you know, like very broad but personal terms. That's pretty much the storyline that I think the Kerry campaign would love to have shape this convention this week.
And adding as the punctuation to that string of descriptors, war hero. Douglas Brinkley, you've written about that chapter in particular. Remind us in very brief of John Kerry's military service. When was it? How long? And how did he perform?
Well, he volunteered for the U.S. Navy in late 1965. Vietnam was just starting to become a troubling reality. And Kerry then was bounced around, training in Newport, Rhode Island, and then was based in San Francisco and homeported in Long Beach, California, and assigned to the USS Gridley. His first tour of duty was aboard the Gridley to Vietnam, where he was from January 1968 till June of 68 on a Pacific tour. Oddly, he returned to the United States back in California the day Bobby Kennedy was assassinated after winning the California primary. He then went to swift boat training back to Massachusetts for a spell, and then to swift boat training in August of 1968. So he spent the famous 68 convention in Chicago, actually in San Diego, training to be a swift boat commander. Those were 50-foot aluminum boats. We've heard a lot about them in recent weeks and months. And then Kerry, on the second tour of duty, was in Vietnam from late October 68 to March of 1969. And most famously, he won the Silver Star and the Bronze Star and three Purple Hearts. Came back in March of 69 and stayed in the U.S. Navy for the remainder of the year, assigned to the Brooklyn Naval Yard under a man named Walter Admiral Walter Schleck, and then, of course, joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
John Vinaki, so there is the heart of the story that we see put forward again and again, and it's in big photographs around the convention hall this week. John Kerry on the river in Vietnam, John Kerry with his Navy buddies in the swift boat, John Kerry in dress whites having the medals pinned on his chest. Why this year, why throughout Kerry's campaign, so much attention to this military experience? Bob Dole had military experience, many other, George McGovern had military experience. Why has John Kerry stood so firmly on these 4.5 months in Vietnam?
Well, I think it's very simple. George W. Bush does not have military experience, or, you know, did not serve overseas, served in the National Guard. That's become a major point of contention or difference, a line of distinction between these two candidates. But I think, to me, this is a personal sticking point, and I don't know if, you know, other here, people here agree. Ted Kennedy was really strong tonight in calling this misguided war, talking about the war in Iraq. He said it made it harder to win war on Al-Qaeda and terrorism that we're fighting in Iraq. And to me, the sticking point continues to be that you have John Kerry, the candidate for president, who made his name and reputation as the person who turned against the war in Vietnam, and he's never spoken those words, misguided war, like describing the Iraq war, to me it seems, there's this gap that I don't quite understand.
Jack Beatty, we're going to devote an entire hour to that very subject tomorrow, but it pertains here. John Kerry presented everywhere around the convention hall in the old photographs of him in military uniform, presenting this as a core credential for leading the country in a time of security threats, for leading the country in a time of war. And yet, unlike Ted Kennedy, his comrade in arms in Massachusetts, unwilling, at least at this point, to call this a misguided war. Is there a tension here or not?
I think there is, and I think the Republicans are going to try to exploit it. I think they're going to use his votes on the war, his position on the war, as a character issue. And I think the issue is going to be they're going to strongly intimate. You voted against Gulf War I, which was justified. There was aggression and so on. You voted for this one, and then you voted against the appropriation. Each time the vote was a political calculation. And, for all your talk about being a Vietnam veteran, that didn't stop you. Your experience, the Vietnam dead, didn't stop you from sending more Americans off to this war, and then from turning around and criticizing me, George Bush, on the war. You want it always, Mr. Kerry.
John, we're going to come back to that subject tomorrow night. It's a rich and deep one. But you've given us the kind of core focus that Ted Kennedy has raised that we're going to hear a lot through this weekend. Every presidential candidate has to have a story. Bill Clinton, the man from hope, George Bush, kind of the feckless youth who turned it around to triumph over his own alcoholism and, the rest, and become Texas governor and then president. So here's John Kerry's war hero, a lifetime of service, as Bill Clinton said last night, the man who always said, send me. Your newspaper, the Boston Globe, has been tough on John Kerry as he's stood up for the presidency this year, but pull back the curtains a little bit for us beyond the kind of iconic story of John Kerry. Who is John Kerry beyond the photo of the Vietnam veteran?
Well, I think that gets to the heart of, the perceived or alleged toughness that the Boston Globe has shown during this campaign. It's not an easy question to answer, even for people who have watched him and covered him for a very long time. And I think we all await his speech with great interest and anticipation to tell us the story. If he can only hope to be half as compelling as Bill Clinton was when he said he was the man who said, send me. Now, I know you can't say that without sounding boastful yourself, but that's the kind of dramatic storyline that people can connect with, I think.
Doug Brinkley, you've written about the military history here in great detail. Do you see the inarguable courage that John Kerry demonstrated on the battlefield? Do you see that running through the rest of his political career, his public life?
Well, look, I mean, Ted Kennedy today, and we were talking about everybody here in Boston at the Democratic National Convention, most of these people are for whoever the Democrat is. We're very partisan country. What Kerry's playing on is this 5 or 7% of the American people, and they don't know him yet. I was astounded to hear 40% of the American people really know nothing about John Kerry. So the battle is for Kerry to convince them that he was a war hero. Americans like war heroes. If you look back in our history, you'll see how many people that were generals. It's astounding, and it's not just Washington and Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant, but most of the presidents after the Civil War, the Rutherford B. Hayes, the Garfields, were Civil War heroes. Theodore Roosevelt in the White House called himself the Colonel, even though he was only at the Battle of San Juan and Kettle Hill for a short period of time. John F. Kennedy would never have made it to the presidency if it hadn't been for the PT-109 incident. So what you're getting with Kerry is that convincing people that he's not a Massachusetts liberal, that he can be tough because, as Jack Beatty rightfully mentioned, he's got an unusual voting record, being against the first Gulf War, the popular one of kicking Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and but being for the unpopular one. And he has to somehow kind of trump that voting record, in a sense, by pure biography, by his TV commercials, and by people starting to see him as a man of courage who volunteers for a lot of these things. And in those ways, I think he's been successful with the Democratic Party, and obviously he's won the nomination. But the question is, can his biography overcome the voting record in some ways, which will seem checkered and confusing to perhaps that 5 or 7%? And I think that's where the political battle lays.
the Soundbite bio, the brave young man in uniform. Let's go back to the podium now where Dick Gephardt is speaking to the Democratic National Convention.
We know he won't take matters of war and peace lightly. John Kerry has the strength to keep America strong. This year, in this election, there's a candidate whose character
I'm Tom
has
Ashbrook.
Shown
this is on point.
The many battles he's taken on for our families. As one of the first Democrats to take on the deficit, as a champion of public education and our children's future, John Kerry has been a leader on these issues for decades. And this year, in this election, there is a candidate who understands middle-class squeeze, who understands what it means for a parent to lose a job, for a family to go without health care, or be hit by rising college costs. As some of you know, I've had a single, simple purpose for my years in public service, to make it possible for hard-working American families to succeed, to help the growing number of families where both parents work just to pay the bills, where life is a never-ending scramble of credit card debt, where it's a struggle to pass on the right values, to teach simple lessons of discipline and respect, right and wrong, to our children. Instead of just helping those at the top, I think we ought to give everyone a chance to reach the top. And if we strengthen all our families, if we make sure our economy enriches everyone, mark my words, the people at the top will do even better. As Dr. Martin Luther King taught us well, I can never be what I ought to be until you can be what you ought to be. If a child doesn't have health insurance, we all pay the price when she shows up at the emergency room. If a child drops out of school, we all pay the price of violence, dependence, and indigence. Words can be cheap in a political year. We all know that. But I'm going to borrow some familiar ones to tell you that we need John Kerry as president because we need a uniter, not a divider, in the White House.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are at the Democratic National Convention tonight, where Dick Gephardt has been at the podium for the last several minutes, and it looks like that will go on. We are talking tonight about the John Kerry story, the Kerry biography, and how it is selling in campaign 2004. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? What most resonates for you in the John Kerry story, and what doesn't? How does the Kerry story compare to George W. Bush's pre-White House bio? And what do you need to see in a candidate story to win your confidence, to win your vote? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe, by our own news analyst Jack Beattie, and right now with us at the Convention Center, Richard Wolff, who's been covering the Kerry campaign for Newsweek magazine. Richard Wolff, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Let's turn to our callers and see what's on their minds as they listen tonight. Melody is calling from Kerry, North Carolina. Hi, Melody. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having this forum. I guess my comment or my question about what resonates for me is the fact that I think war is a dynamic process. And John Kerry started in 1965 fighting in a Vietnam War that was not the same in 1970. And he's had that experience of seeing how things change and then being able to change his mind. My guess is that in the United States, what we thought the war in Iraq was when we started is clearly not what we think it is now. I don't think after the weapons of mass destruction issue faded that we expected that we would be in this position. Certainly I, as a voter who never really was for it, was swayed definitely by the argument. And since I had so many friends and colleagues and patients who were either fighting in Iraq or had children fighting in Iraq, my feeling really changed. I think having somebody who's been there and knows how it feels be able to then say, yes, this is a different situation.
Yes.
Melanie, we've got it, and it's a terrific point that you raise. I think maybe it's best put to Douglas Brinkley, who's with us, author of the Kerry biography, Tour of Duty. Doug Brinkley, take us back to John Kerry's train of thought in the 60s and 70s, as Melanie describes here, when his opinions evolved in the Vietnam War as that war evolved.
Well, that I think the caller makes a pretty good point. I mean, the Kerry who signs up in 1965 and it's a different Vietnam War in 65. By 1968, the country had largely turned against the war, and Kerry's cynicism, skepticism about the war increases. Part of it is because his friend, like Dick Pershing, we've heard a lot about recently, the great-grandson of General Black, Jack Pershing, was killed over there. But mainly when he got in-country, started going up the Mekong Delta rivers, he just started seeing how ludicrous American policy was. Keep in mind, in 68, though, Kerry was for Bobby Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy. He admired a great deal, meaning he was a liberal Democrat already. And a book that he carried with him throughout 68 was called To Make a Newer World by Robert Kennedy. And I once saw his copy of it in his Boston library, and Senator Kennedy still has it. And it's just vigorously underlined and circled in pencil. And Robert Kennedy's views on Vietnam, in a sense, became John Kerry's view of 68. So by the 1971, when Kerry makes that famous testimony in front of the Fulbright Committee, when he says, how do you ask a man to be a last man to die for a mistake? Kerry was a veteran who knew what was wrong from Vietnam from a military perspective, from a personal hands-on experience, but also he was echoing beliefs of Ed Muskie, Ted Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy and other leading lights in the Democratic Party at that point. The country had soured on Vietnam by 1971. In many ways, Kerry was not an isolated voice, but simply the leader of the VVAW, Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Hardly isolated then. That's the evolution then. Let's look at the evolution now and how it's playing. Richard Wolff, you've spent a lot of time with John Kerry on the campaign trail. His GOP critics accusing him, looking back, of trying to have it both ways in Vietnam and once again trying to have it both ways in Iraq. What do you see on the hustings? How does John Kerry's chest full of medals play? Is it convincing as a kind of a imprimatur of experience that says this man understands war or something else?
It does, for the most part. It does communicate that he knows something about war. A lot depends on how he phrases it. And one of his best lines is, for instance, America shouldn't go to war because it wants to. It should only go to war because it has to. And those kinds of references to war are pretty effective, not at the personal level, but at a policy level. I still think that the Republicans have done a much better job of framing him as a flip-flopper. The caller made a great point when we were discussing the cover story in Newsweek this week. We were talking about the flip-flopper issue. We were talking about him as a man. How do we deal with this flip-flopping issue? And there are people who think he flip-flopped on Vietnam. And there are other people who think he was actually very principled going in and coming out. I think Kerry still has to do a job of framing Iraq in similar terms. At the moment, the Republican Party has done a much better job of framing it for him.
But just basic level, when the photos are put up, when the Vietnam vets stand by him, many Americans are just being introduced to this man. It's been pointed out that for Bob Dole, for George McGovern, military experience didn't send them on any free ride to the White House, and nothing like it. Is it working for John Kerry now in the midst of war on terror, in the midst of Iraq war, the simple image of him in uniform? Do you see it reassuring American voters getting introduced to this man that he can handle a time of security threat and war?
When they tell the story, it does. You'd be surprised, though. You see it a lot here, but I was talking to David Alston, who's the South Carolina minister we heard last night, very powerful. I saw him last in South Carolina in the primaries. He hasn't been out campaigning with Kerry since. So they have been actually fairly quiet about the story, even though you'd think from the TV ads they're talking about it all the time. So I think they've still got a big job to do there in telling that story.
Let's turn back to the podium on the convention floor where Democratic Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle is addressing the Assembly.
He dedicated his life to public service. He worked first as a prosecutor putting criminals behind bars. And as a United States Senator, John Kerry has stood up to the drug companies and fought the lower prices for seniors. And he has continued to fight for his brothers in arms. I know. We fought side by side for veterans' health care, justice for victims of Agent Orange, and a full accounting of all Americans, POWs, and soldiers missing in action. We've done that.
Tom Daschle on the convention floor tonight speaking to the delegates. So here we are, Joan Vernocchi. Kerry's story is more than that uniform, yet the uniform is front and center. Richard Wolff saying he's not always playing the big veterans card. We haven't seen the big veteran card played on stage yet this week, but we know Max Cleland, you know, triple amputee from Vietnam, is going to be introducing him on Thursday night. It's sure to come, I guess.
Yes, it is. And the whole theme this week, you know, when in events all around the city have played upon the veteran thing. I think the biography on its own is helpful, but not enough to close the deal as we keep on writing and saying. And again, not to belabor the Ted Kennedy speech, with other people might not have listened to as closely as we did, but what he said, he's the right man for this time. I think the campaign has to link the story of his life to why he is the right man for this time, and that could be a convincing argument to people when they weigh it against George Bush and the decisions that he made.
Jack Beatty, it is in some ways a novel challenge for a man to so need to define himself, even at this point in a campaign where he's been out there a lot.
And has been a United States senator for 20 years. There's no major piece of legislation that I can think of, and I followed him all that while that he's had, he sponsored. His reputation in the Senate was of someone who picked his issues in order to get attention rather than necessarily to advance issues. Very different from Teddy Kennedy, who used up all kinds of political capital on issues. You know, on this war business, on this biography, he, in some strange way, he's never been able to find the political, a civilian equivalent of his courage in Vietnam. You know, you hear that story and you think this is a tower of political courage. This is a guy who stands up and is counted. That has not been his profile as a senator, and some would argue that really hasn't been his profile as a candidate. And in a strange way, I think people hear that story and they expect more from the man than he delivers.
Richard Wolff, what about it? Of course, he turned his boat into enemy fire, famously, Mekong Delta. In politics?
He did. I actually would disagree strongly. I think in the Senate, he has actually done some pretty courageous things. And exhibit A on that is the POW MIA stuff. No political gain, obvious political gain. A huge amount of crossfire on all sides.
Well, he went back to settle this with Vietnam, and it led, of course, to the reestablishment of formal relations with him.
Absolutely. This was political dynamite. It was foreign policy formation as well. It was a huge achievement to get that through committee with a unanimous vote, given the strength of feeling. I mean, we reported, you know, there were Republican senators who were almost at blows with each other over this in committee, and he pulled them together. I think that was, you go and talk to some of those Republicans who still believe there are POWs out there, and they have nothing but good words to say about John Kerry. That was a big achievement.
Joan.
Give him that one. I think Vietnam is his one passion, and he acted on it in that situation, but there are no other examples that I know of. I'd give him that one.
And yet he's bringing a kind of steadiness over that time, and in Bill Clinton's words last night, a wisdom to the table, or at least he's being portrayed as part of the story now, at a time when the Democrats clearly feel they need that. The Democrats looked at his record in Iowa and across the primary season when they had a lot of options, and they said, we want the tall, craggy guy with those years in the Senate.
And just to, you know, to give it back to Richard a little bit here, if Newsweek still has to debate, is he a flip-flopper or not? At this stage in the campaign, you could say it's the Republicans who have framed it that way, but you could also say that Senator Kerry has been unable to answer that question to put it finally to sleep.
Let's turn to our callers once more. Justin is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Oh, how are you doing there, sir? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
You talked about 30 minutes ago about someone who really... what kind of person do you want for the Democratic Party for
yes.
to become president? I, as a moderate Democrat, really want somebody that can get out of the shadow of the past past Democratic leaders and really kind of branch over. And I think that anyone that can get together with other, be really bipartisan on many issues and where some people call it flip-flopping, he can actually get away from the, I guess you can say, shadow of the Kennedys and really become his own person.
Well, now there's an interesting thought. Justin, let us pick that up. Richard Wolff, how about it? Is John Kerry the politician who can work the middle, who can bridge between parties? He's clearly not as polarizing as Bill Clinton was. Right. Can he fill our caller Justin's hopes of a Democratic leader who could reach out, who could span that enormous chasm between parties right now?
I think he probably can, and I think that's why you saw that open flirtation with John McCain to be on his ticket. He works very well. He's worked well with Jesse Helms, of all people, on Iran-Contra. You know, he cuts a strange profile. I think he is very independent, and for all of his liberal positions on many social issues, he's shown he can work with Republicans, and he looks at stuff not so much on personality. If he did, I think he'd actually be he'd be more popular in his own party. That's really the rap against John Kerry. Why doesn't he have more friends with Democrats? He seems to actually do fairly well with the Republicans, and it's kind of oddball mix. So I think he can reach out. You know, he's got to obviously convince voters that he can unite the country. That's why they talk about the Swift boat. Everybody's in the same boat, he says, literally. He doesn't really mean that, but that's the kind of image he's trying to get.
Joan, we can't leave this night without talking for just a moment, and we only have a minute, about his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, who will take the podium later this evening. A very distinctive woman in her own right. How do you think she's playing? Net positive, net negative for the Kerry candidacy?
Well, I think she's had an interesting and somewhat difficult week, which I believe is pretty understandable given the pressures and just the exhaustion that must come from being on the campaign trail like
Pittsburgh
that.
Pittsburgh reported to shove it yesterday, not exactly baking cookies.
Not exactly ladylike talk, especially after she had talked about having civil discourse in campaigns. But you know what? You know, who really cares about that? I mean, it's like human nature sometimes to lash out. I don't think you want to do it too often just because it hands your opponents an issue. And John Kerry doesn't want to do that on any level right now.
Well, that just about wraps it up for the night. Doug Brinkley, final thought on the Kerry candidacy. How do you see it going from the biographer's vantage?
Well, it was interesting. Ted Kennedy gave an important speech, and John Kerry's first foray into politics was campaigning for Ted Kennedy back in 1962. And we were talking about Kerry's legislative accomplishments. One of his great political achievements has been navigating the ocean that is Ted Kennedy over the years. He's not been able to sponsor legislation in a lot of areas.
Ted has been there.
Been the junior senator.
But tonight, what goes around comes around. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Douglas Brinkley, author of Tour of Duty, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
And Richard Wolff, Newsweek magazine, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Joan Vernocchi of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, we'll see you right back here at Convention Central tomorrow night. Great to have you with us.
We're on the same boat.
On the same boat. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.